Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dozy, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Arturo Gonzalez McDowell, President and CEO of Eurobits. For more than 30 years, Arturo has been a pioneer in the fintech space across Europe. He is a leader and visionary in spaces such as electronic payments, mobile banking, electronic invoicing, and account information services. Arturo was also the first person to offer account information services in Europe through a product that was rolled out through Eurobits in 2004. So we're really happy and excited to have Arturo on the show to share his knowledge with us. Hey, Arturo, great to have you on the show today.
Hello, good morning. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Great. Let's kick off the show and let's paint a picture for the listeners before we jump into the Eurobits story. And maybe we can start at your early career and talk through some parts of that and focusing on how the early part of your career helped you succeed at Eurobits.
So I would say there are a couple of things that helped me. So first, I think there are a couple of personality traits. One is I think I've only learned the term relatively recently, but I've learned that I'm a divergent thinker, meaning that I tend to think differently than most people. Let me just explain the concept. Typically, people tend to converge to a couple of information poles. So typically in politics, you would have the left and the right. And divergent thinkers tend to diverge from those poles and think completely different. So let me just give you an example. You could have a conversation on whether this is black or white. And a divergent thinker might say, well, look, this is loud. This is not about colors, it's about noise. So I think I have that characteristic, which if correctly directed, would lead you to be creative in a way. A divergent thinker doesn't necessarily have to be a creative person, but to be creative, you need to be divergent. You can't think what everybody else is thinking. In addition, I think I'm optimist by nature. So that means that I tend to put divergent thinking to work in a number of things that I believe that are going to succeed in the future. And then in terms of subject areas, when I started working, I started at IBM. So I started our career in IT or information services. And also closely related to banking or financial services. And in addition, everything related to innovation. So I had a career which started in cryptography. Then I moved to stuff like electronic commerce and payments. And I had the opportunity to be involved in very innovative projects from the very beginnings. So I guess the common thread in my career is IT, financial services and innovation. So I was involved, for instance, in the launch of the first mobile banking service with Banesto, now part of the Banco Santander group, and also in the first electronic payment transactions using the SET protocol back in the mid-90s. And at a later stage, I was involved in the first account aggregation services in a company and a Spanish company called Isoco, which stands for Intelligent Software Components, which fortunately no longer exists. And we developed the first pieces of software devoted to account aggregation in Europe. So I think all this so set a trend that maybe is suitable for a company such as Eurobits.
Tell me more about this divergent thinker that you mentioned. You mentioned two great examples. One is creativity and the other is being able to have a different opinion and a different view and think differently to other people. How have these characteristics sort of helped you along your journey?
Well, they have helped me because let's say if you have a more of a being a divergent thinker or being creative, it doesn't make you smarter than other type of people. It's just the sort of stuff that you devote your mind to is just different. But if you have more of an engineering mindset, then you tend to see more obstacles than opportunities. And it's very difficult to innovate with that mindset. That doesn't mean that. So let me be clear, you can be an engineer and be creative. I'm just speaking about mindset. So in order to be creative, you have to be open to exploration of uncharted territory, which is what a divergent thinker does by nature.
And I guess going into a company such as Europe, this type of thinking would have helped you as you started rolling out different products into different parts of Europe over the last 16 years, right?
This combination of the creativeness and optimism is what makes you think, look, this account aggregation, as it was initially called, the term open banking is relatively recent. And bear in mind that Eurobit was launched in 2004. So interesting for both individuals and companies alike, the possibility of seeing all your financial information in one place versus going to many other places, and in a way that can be integrated with value-added services such as personal financial management or cash management or account and invoice reconciliation. So you tend to focus more on that than on the problem. So what's connectivity that the average customer has? I'm talking 2005, 2006, when not everybody had an internet connection at home or the bandwidth was not enough. So you tend to focus on the opportunity. So this is so beneficial for people that it will ultimately succeed, whereas a more engineering-minded person would say, well, look, only X percent of the population is suited for this, so let's do something else.
I hear you. And you mentioned you worked at IBM, and I also know you did a stint out in Santander. So going forward, what was your, and moving out of maybe that, you know, corporate, those big corporates, what was your motivation to join a company like Eurobit back in the 2000s?
Well, first, I was working at a monster like IBM until early 2001, and I saw lots of opportunities or trains passing in front of me. So remember, we're talking about the bubble times. So I thought that I might be missing opportunities. And at the same time, I felt a bit tight in the suit of a corporation. So I jumped for an opportunity that was not a very good opportunity. It was a company called Peregrine Systems, which had a very good portfolio, but it was a bit of a shaky company in terms of the way it did business. Actually, it ended filing for bankruptcy for wrongdoing. So, but you tend to learn a lot from failures. And from there, I jumped to Soco, the company that I mentioned before, which was a company full of PhDs and very smart people from lots of different nationalities. So it was a very fertile ground for innovation. Actually, a number of interesting companies from there, companies such as Strands or BigML or others, emerged from people that at some point were there. And it is in this company where we started account aggregation in Europe. But at some point, the dot-com bubble exploded, and we had a very difficult time with financing. And the company viability was a big question mark. So at the same time, Bankinter, a very innovative Spanish bank, had launched an account aggregation service on their own. It was very difficult to sustain this service because the technology was very expensive. So this is now commonplace, but at that time it was in the rocket science space, so to speak. And so they wanted to spin off this technology and create a new company. And so we discussed the opportunity of also spinning off the technology from Isoco and doing a joint venture, but that didn't work out from the Soco side, unfortunately. And so another Spanish bank, Cajamadrid, was brought into scene. Bankinter and Cajamadrid decided to create the company by themselves, and they called me to manage it. So I was essentially the first employee in the company with a request to launch it from zero.
Well, that must have been pretty exciting times.
Yes, definitely. I guess there are other things that they took into account for thinking that I was the right person. But one of them was that I had a couple of years in my belt of running an account aggregation business, or not a service, mind you, it was software. So again, early 2000s, software as a service was not a big thing. Actually, in our initial presentations, we had two or three slides to explain what that meant and why it made sense. And yeah, it was very, very exciting times. Very hard as well, because as I implied in one of my comments, the market was not mature enough for account aggregation or open banking. So we had our own journey through the desert. First, the financial space in Europe is significantly different to the financial space in the US. I'm speaking retail here. In the US, the retail financial market space is extremely fragmented, because as an individual, you're forced to have accounts in a number of financial institutions. So you would have your checking account in one bank, and then you would have your credit cards in a different bank, and your mortgages in a third one, and your insurance in a fourth one. due to US banking regulation. So in the US, it makes a lot more sense than in Europe, or the incentives to launch account aggregation are much higher than in Europe. In Europe, that's not the case. Most European citizens can live with just one bank account. In addition to this geographical difference or the way people behave in the different geographies, there were other restrictions. One I mentioned, which is connectivity, but probably the biggest one was the readiness of the customer base. So people in the early 2000s were not ready to share sensitive information with a third party. So things had to change. And fortunately for us, social networks came to the rescue. So with the advent of companies such as Facebook and Twitter, when people started sharing extremely sensitive information in social networks through the internet, then if I'm sharing these pictures with my friends in Facebook, which might stop me from making the cut in my next job interview, why wouldn't I share financial information with this third party that is going to help me better manage my finances? So this was, I would say, around the year 2008. When things started changing significantly. So BBVA launched its BBVA Tu Cuentas service, which was portrayed by Forrester Research as how future of banking would look like. And they were spot on, because that's what all banks in Europe are doing now, 12 years later. So yeah, we went through our journey through the desert, and it was very interesting times. We learned a lot, and fortunately we made it to the oasis.
Tell me a bit more about that early part of the journey. I mean, you obviously, you guys were pioneers, you were leaders in the space at that time. How did you go out and get your product to market? And more than that, get your product out into different parts of the European landscape?
So this was challenging. Fortunately, I had been working in the banking sector in Spain for a long time. I know how relationships work, what triggers decisions in the innovation space. So basically what we were selling were opportunity cost projects versus ROI projects. So we were not selling, this is going to make your bottom line look better next year. What we were selling is, look, this is going to take off. And if you don't catch a train early enough, you might never make it to the next station. If you know the different banks and how they are perceived, you know who you have to target first, because if they make a positive decision, others will follow. So basically, we started having a significant customer base thanks to that buying logic. So we convinced the most forward-thinking banks that they should embrace these sort of projects. And then the more mainstream banks followed, because what if this becomes a success and we're not there? And in terms of Europe, so growing out in Europe, that came a lot later. To be honest, we were quite opportunistic. So we did not think in advance, we have to go to this and that market. So we followed opportunities that came along, mostly through partners. And the reason we had this opportunity is because, as I said, in the early stages, there were not that many, so maybe calling it rocket science is a bit too much, but there were not that many companies in Europe that had the knowledge, the experience to establish banking connections in a given country and deliver the information for the end user successfully. There's a steep learning curve in terms of experience, the sort of things that happen when you do that. So let me just give you a few examples. So the way the IT architecture in banking works is that you have an online window most of the day, but then you have some batch processes running behind. And then certain products might not be available in a certain time frame. For instance, a large Spanish institution, your loans would disappear from your online banking from 10 to 11 because there was a consolidation process going in behind and they would just not show it. Another significant Spanish bank might have the pending movements from your credit card with a minus sign. And after that batch process at a certain time of the day, they would change signs. So these sort of things, so from a technology perspective, they're not complex, but there are lots of details and stuff that you find out through very hard work, through a long period of time, how they work in most banks. So as I say, there were very little companies in Europe that could do this at scale. And we had proven with a number of large Spanish banks that we could do it successfully. Banks and non-banks. Mm-hmm. So fintechs like Fintonic.
And you mentioned partner network. And what do you mean by that? I mean, what exactly was the partner network bring into the scale journey or the growth journey?
So basically, this would vary from company to company, but we were a very specialized in a part of the value chain. So basically, what you're a bit specialized at is establishing connections between banks and applications that use the information from the user base in the banks. So we're basically a plumber that establishes connections between the source of the information and the destination of the information. So in order for that to have value, you need an application that triggers those connections, that handles user data, that enable those connections to function properly. So in simpler terms, that store user IDs and passwords and personal information, as well as being able to store the information that we retrieve from those sources of information. And of course, adding all the value on top of that. So if that application is a PFM, beyond storing the user information and the information from the source that they have retrieved through us, they need to have added value such as managing my budget and all sorts of rules and functionalities related to personal finance management. So in the end, when Bank Z from country X in Europe wants a solution, we're only a part of that solution. So we partner with a number of companies that had what we missed and we had what they missed. We went jointly to these opportunities and we were very successful in a number of them.
Okay, that makes complete sense. And it sounds like it's quite a big infrastructure that you're building up over the course of those years. How did your team have to transform and, I guess, expand as you scale, you know, both your infrastructure side of your business and also the other parts of your business?
First thing is, I guess you guessed it by now, but our growth was not linear. So we had good and bad times. We had a especially tough time after the financial crisis of 2008, but with a very big lag. First, because for a number of reasons, the way that crisis affected the Spanish economy was different than in other geographies, and it was later. Plus, well, the way it impacted in our business was also different. So basically, we started losing a number of significant customers due to mergers and acquisitions. In addition, our model had, so we have the typical SaaS pricing structure. So you have a setup fee, a fixed monthly fee, and a variable fee. And all of a sudden, the setup fees stopped coming in because the Spanish economy, which is where we focused at that point in time, was completely stagnant. So we've had periods of growth before that and then being able to adjust our size to the new situation. And then after we recover from that, which coincidentally happened at the time we performed an MBO. So as I mentioned earlier, the company was founded by a couple of Spanish banks, Bankinter and Caja Madrid, now part of Bankia. But others joined, Bancaja, also part of Bankia, Caja Mar and Caja Laboral. And Bankia happened to be one of the Spanish banks that had to bail out. That gave us the opportunity to do a management buyout. So basically by 2014, which is when that started happening, we had turned the company around. And we did it in a beautiful way, of which I am extremely proud of, which is, so there was nobody willing, none of the shareholders were willing to come to the rescue. So basically, the employees had to rescue the company. So we made a big sacrifice with the promise of a prize at the end of the journey, which fortunately came, and we turned the company completely around. So then we started growing from there. And then with the site put in growing faster than ever, we onboarded a C-level team. Bear in mind, I've been alone in terms of management for a significant part of the 17 years that I've been at Eurobiz. So we reached a point where I thought I could no longer do it all. So I hired a C-level team, a CTO, a CFO, and a chief revenue officer. And that's the way we prepared ourselves for the next stage of growth. And in terms of the infrastructure, we were, for most of our life, a co-location company, meaning that we had our own hardware sitting in racks in one of these co-location companies. Again, preparing for growth, we needed to change and industrialize all of our business processes. Until that point, I think we were a very good company that served its customers very well, but we were you could consider ourselves a bunch of artisans. So that's good to a certain point, but it's difficult to grow from there. So we had to significantly industrialize the company. So this is something that may not apply to many of the listeners, because I guess we are a strange animal that we could not be considered a startup company in terms of age. And that has an impact in many things inside the company. But from a different perspective, we were a startup. So we were, we were a different animal. So some of the things I'm saying may not be applicable to most listeners.
I mean, it's interesting that you know, the employees bought the company out and you guys picked it up in 2014 and started turning it around and brought in the team to obviously help you. I mean, if you could tell me more about the business process side of things and the structures that you industrialized, how that, maybe what a couple of examples of what had to get fixed and how that actually helped you along that growth journey or the next period of growth for you guys.
Basically, you need to compartmentalize stuff. So when you're very small, it makes sense to have a reduced number of very smart people that are jacks of all trades. But then that reaches a limit and you need to begin changing roles. So you need to separate development from technical support, from customer support. In order to be efficient, you need to define the processes on the way all these different departments communicate and how things are sorted out. And also what is extremely relevant is that you develop a more explicit company culture to make sure that when you start hiring people for growth, that you hire the right people, which is probably one of the most essential factors for success in a startup.
Yeah, no, I guess as you shift and you're building the processes, you're changing the org structure, you put in, you know, new communication mechanisms and company culture. There's also things to look out for, such as making certain you don't embed silos into the company as you're going through growth.
There are a number of risks. So this is difficult to structure, but a company has different phases. So basically, we reached a phase. So most of our life, Eurobiz was a company that could be managed by shouting. And by shouting, I don't mean by shouting out loud to people to give orders. But I mean that whenever you set a person in the other corner of the room, everybody heard it. So there was no need to have formal channels of communication because everybody was aware of almost everything. And the trust between everybody comes natural. But then as you start to grow, I would say the limit for such a company is 20-something people. Mm. So this is my personal feeling, and it can be corrected by anybody who has a different idea. So I think that there's a model for a company that is, let's say, 20 people in size, but then the next model starts working at 40, and there's nothing in between. So you have a no man's zone unless you have enough funding, which is something we lacked of. So we were a bootstrap company. So there's a lot of turbulence between going from one model to the next. And you need to be aware of this and you need to be able to manage it. So if you don't have enough resources, it's very difficult to put the formal communication channels. So you have sort of a hybrid model between the 20 and 40 people organization model, and things creak at some point, but you have to be aware of it. You have to manage it. It requires a lot of time and probably it's highly inefficient. So the best thing to tackle this, and this is one of the lessons I've learned, is there's a point where you no longer should be a bootstrap company and you should look for funding earlier than we did.
There's some really great insights there. And I guess you on the growth journey again, you're evolving, you're changing your company, your culture. How did you guys continuously evolve your products at this stage and make certain that, you know, you were always delivering the best to your customers day in, day out?
Well, I think basically there's one choice you have to make here, and you have to be very clear about it. Do you want to be a customer-driven company or you want to be a market-driven company? If you're a market-driven company, you need a number of very smart product marketing people determining what kind of product and services the market will need and focusing all your energy into the creation of these products and marketing those products. And these requires a lot of funding because nobody is going to pay you for a product you're going to have in 2 years' time from now. And then there's a customer-driven company, which is what we were. And I think we were very good at it. We spoke to the right people at the most significant customers. We listened to them. We understood their needs and developed what they needed. And that means that you're prepared to evolve your products with immediate funding from the customer, which is a completely different approach to a market-driven company. And I think we were pretty good at it because typically it's very difficult to be at the forefront of a technology market with this approach, with a significant customer base. And I think we managed reasonably well. I will let others judge, but we were good at listening and we were fast at delivering what customers needed.
And I guess if you're good at listening, you're always going to be able to understand the customer's pain points and the customer's problems, and then, you know, deliver those solutions that solve the problems, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this requires a mixture of market knowledge, of knowing the customer, and being able to know what technology helps solve that problem.
What do you think is the most valuable or important lesson you've learned and taken away from your journey?
The most valuable lesson is that you need to choose the right people. So what's going to make it or break it is having the right team. That plus luck. But there's not much you can do about luck. So choosing the right people is absolutely essential. So you need people that have the right cultural fit, and that having that cultural fit, that they are loyal to the company, that trumps everything else. I'd rather have a smart person that is the right cultural fit and that is going to be loyal and stand by the company during tough times than a genius that is going to jump boats at his earliest convenience and that might not fit with the culture of the company. And I had bad experiences with this. At some points, I learned the hard way. Just to give you a relatively recent example, we had a CTO that left the company between signing and closing with Tink, and that put the whole deal into risk. And we, fortunately, we managed it well from both sides. We succeeded, but it doesn't matter how good that CTO was. If you're going to put the company at risk, you're of no value.
Some good points again you raised there. I mean, when you say put the company at risk, what do you mean by that?
Well, typically when you sign an acquisition deal, there are a number of conditions precedent and covenants that you sign. And typically you identify a list of key people that cannot leave before closing. And obviously your CTO will always be in that list. Beyond this, for me, key lesson learned about choosing the right people, there are a couple of more specific to our context or environment, things that I learned, which I think might be of value to our listeners, is the influence of supervision. Mm. So we became a supervised entity in September 2019 through PSD2. And I think I undervalued the impact of being supervised on the business. So it suddenly makes you a lot slower because you have to take into account all the legal restrictions, you need people to do compliance, etc. And that means that what was a previously profitable business might not be profitable anymore or makes less profit. You should never underestimate the influence of supervision in the way you run the company. And also, I think it was very interesting times to learn how lobbying and lawmaking in the EU works, because I, together with some colleagues of some of my peer companies, worked very hard a number of years in Europe to make sure that PSD2 steered in the right direction, which was not 100% right at some points. Fortunately, I think we helped take it to a reasonable point. So that was very, very interesting, very exciting, but may not apply to everyone.
Yeah, and you mentioned early on that there's been an acquisition, and I know you guys are going through a different part of your journey right now. Did you, give us a bit of a clue as to what's happening next?
So, well, maybe it makes sense to briefly explain the motivations for the deal. So one of the things as the CEO of any kind of company is to be introspective and be realistic about your characteristics, your limitations, etc., and on what you really want. In my case, I had been leading Eurobets for 16 years. To be honest, to a large extent, my batteries were drained. And I had in my mind that what brought us here might not be what is required to take us there. I, like everybody else, has its limitations. And maybe I was not, so this is a question mark. I will never know because I didn't try. Maybe I was not the right person to take Eurobits to the next level. So we had the opportunity to partner with Tink, which to that point was one of our competitors, one of our strongest competitors. And we thought it was the right company to take open banking to the next level in the EU and beyond. So that was the motivation. And what I think the future holds, well, on one hand, there's a sentimental part. So Eurobits will cease to exist in the near future. And so more than cease to exist, it will change names, right? But there's a sentimental part, but there's a much more exciting part that completely supersedes this, which is the fact that we're going to be a significant part of the company that's going to lead open banking in Europe and beyond. So it's extremely exciting. I think also I'm very eager to learn how Tink is doing things differently than we did at Eurobits. Tink is more a market-driven company than a customer-driven company. And so this is a different way to do things. I'm very eager to learn and always questioning how I can add value to help Tink reach its ambitious objectives.
So it seems like a really exciting time. And right now, what questions are you and your senior team asking yourselves? And what factors are you considering as you sort of go on this new journey with Tink?
One, as I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons I look for this partnership is because I needed a break. So I'm no longer in the first line. I don't have an executive role at Tink. So my main concern and that of my senior executives at Eurobits is to make sure that there's a smooth transition, that people feel at home at Tink as they did at Eurobits, and that we successfully migrate our platform into the Tink platform and are accustomed with it. And we are all completely focused in achieving this objective in the near future.
It sounds like you guys are definitely on a great path and a great next step forward. But outside of that, I mean, I know that a lot of leaders, entrepreneurs, and the like continue learning. And, you know, on that point, so it would be interesting to know if you have read or are reading any books currently that you think our listeners might like to put into their collection.
Yes, sure. The ones I'm reading now are closely related to my current situation, so might not be applicable to everyone, although it doesn't hurt starting reading them now. So one is Rich Dad, Poor Dad from Robert Kiyosaki. I think that this book has been an eye-opener, and I wish I had read it before. But now, after selling my stake at Eurobits, I have to make financial decisions, which I hadn't had to make in the past. And also, I'm reading a very interesting paper from Merrill Lynch, which is called Beyond Market Weight. So it's an asset allocation framework for investors. But so maybe these two are very contextual to the situation I'm living. But some recent book that I read, or not so recent, that I would recommend to anybody in my pants would be, one is Peak Performance by Brad Stuhlberg and Steve Magnus, which is basically a book that explores what successful people have in common from any discipline, from singers to writers to scientists to businessmen. And there are a number of key areas that all of this have and that tend to be overlooked by most people, including myself. Most notoriously, the lack of certain routines and the lack of rest. Probably we tend to think that we're better if we overwork. And the truth is that is the complete opposite. Then another one that I just finished, which is very linked to the previous one, is Atomic Habits, which is to understand why habits work and how to get rid of bad habits and stick with good ones. Very, very interesting book and more applicable to the audience in particular. I think it's a very, very good book. I think it's a must read for any entrepreneur, which is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. That book was an eye-opener about many stuff related to successfully running a company.
Oh, cool. I mean, I think you're going to keep us busy. there's a number of really great books there.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely amazing in listening to your journey and so inspired, actually, listening to you and all the stuff you've gone through. You know, thanks for coming on the show. But before we clock off, I mean, if people wanted to get in touch with you, how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, LinkedIn would be a very good way. email. I would share the email, but it's going to change soon, so maybe it's not the best source. But LinkedIn would be the so I always answer all requests. But before we end, so I think I've been moderately successful. I think the percent of people that start a company and then selling it for a profit is relatively small. So in that sense, I haven't become a billionaire or anything similar, but I think it's a reasonable margin of success that I've had. But I think what most people don't realize is that the key element for this is luck. I know there are people much smarter than me that might have worked much harder than me and that haven't been successful because luck was not on their side. And this is something that's beyond you. Of course, luck as inspiration needs to arrive when you're working. So hard work is always a requirement. Hard and smart work is required, but without luck, you will make no. So that's why I'm very grateful. And one of the things I would like to do beyond helping Tink become the open banking leader is to sort of give back to society and share what I've learned with everyone. So in order to try to make others, if they have a luck on their side as well, to be successful.
Yeah, really inspiring. And listen, I mean, if anyone wants to get in touch with you, definitely. You know, all I can say to my listeners, Arturo is a really great guy. Get in touch, learn if you want to learn, right? And that's what we're here to do on the FinTech Scaling Show. And it's been amazing. Again, absolutely amazing having you on the show. And we're very lucky to have someone of your stature and all your knowledge come on the FinTech Scaling Show today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.